You've tuned in to the First Few Moments podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The First Few Moments podcast is the most up-to-date source for responder best practice discussions and incident review. Join industry leaders and seasoned providers at firstfewmoments.com. You can talk to us through Twitter at First Few Moments, email us at podcast@firstfewmoments.com, or call us at 716-245-5FFM. Nice, I got that. Safety.
Oh, that's going in.
Yeah, put it at the end.
And action.
Hello and welcome, everybody, to First Few Moments, your bi-weekly podcast about managing your scene, where we discuss safety management, triage, and care. My name is Kyle David Bates, and we are back. We're trying to get onto a more of a regular schedule. We've kind of had a little bit of a hiatus during the holiday months, but a lot is going on with First Few Moments. A lot of stuff we'll be talking about here in the next few months. Hint, hint, potential publication is where I'll put this for our program, so we're excited about that. But we're going to keep the podcast going as an integral part of the program, as a continuing education for that. So we got a pretty good panel on tonight. I'm kind of excited about who we have. And the first person we have is Mr. Tim Noonan, the Rogue Medic. How are you, sir, today?
Doing well. How are you?
I am great, great. Actually moving. You looking forward to...
Are you regular?
Am I regular? I am always regular. Probably not regular
good
enough sometimes. Yeah.
Or do it for you every time.
And that voice you just heard there is Mr. Kelly Grayson, the Ambo driver. How are you today, Kelly?
I'm fine, Kyle.
So thank you for coming on with us tonight. We also have Mr. Bob Lutz. Bob, how are you today?
Doing good, Kyle. Good to be with you.
I'm so glad to have you. Bob, this is only about your second or third time on the show, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Bob's a paramedic in the Tonawanda. We also have Mr. Russell Stein. Mr. Russell, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
You sound so happy and thrilled.
Well, you kind of caught me off guard, or else I'd be a little bit more prepared.
That's what I'm good for. That's what we try to do.
Moving on.
All right, thanks, Russell. And folks, our pre show is definitely an interesting aspect. So if it rolls over into the show, this could be definitely an interesting discussion today. And of course, finally joining us is Dr. Lori Romig from Florida. How are you today?
I'm great. Although I was wondering if you were going to forget me or not.
I'm never going to forget you.
Oh, okay.
Save the best for last.
Promises.
Save the best for last.
Okay.
All right. So let's go ahead and let's just get right into this. We're going to talk about spine immobilization. It has been a common topic on podcasts for about the last year and a half, 2 years. And I kind of want to bring this from the standpoint of car accidents. And I was working in a system once where we went to a motor vehicle crash. And the fire department, who do not really do much EMS, they're certified responders, got off their trucks. Each one of them in their hand had a cervical collar in it. They went into the car and automatically applied the cervical collar. Now, mind you, this is not a high-speed, backcountry road, you know, severe trauma. This was a simple fender bender in a intersection where everybody was stopped and the car behind them just kind of slid a little bit on the ice. There's no damage to any of the cars. Really, no one had any complaints, but everybody got a cervical collar. Now, growing up in EMS, I've been in EMS for over 20 years, pretty much anyone that was in a car accident got a backboard and collar. And it's pretty much became almost the standardized care in EMS for motor vehicle crashes. But lately, we've been seeing that maybe we're not doing the right thing for our patients. And I gathered this panel together today to kind of talk a little bit about that as to, I mean, why do we put people on backboards? Should we even be considering it? When should we not? And kind of debating some of those aspects. So when I was doing the research for the show, I came across one of Kelly's articles on EMS1.com called A Better Way to Backboard. And he kind of introduces it with a kind of an interesting way. And Kelly, I'm going to let you take it from there.
Yeah, it was, we were looking at one of the modular pediatric and adult backboards at EMS today, and I noticed while we were demoing this backboard that Montera and a couple of the other guys with me had never seen the method of log rolling, where you place the board somewhat, you know, maybe a couple of feet higher than the head of the patient. So when you roll them, log roll them back on the board, and they're invariably never centered on the board. When you center them on the board, you can move them up along the axis of the spine instead of against it. And so I wrote that little column on doing that little trick. And a preface was saying, you know, it's rather odd for me to put this in here, showing you a better way to do a skill that I no longer believe is necessary. It's like, you know, this is here's how to do something I don't believe in anymore. But there you have it. I think the best way to backboard would be to not do it in about 75% of the cases.
So, Kelly, why do you feel that way? I mean, this is as common as placing, I'm using this example on purpose, as oxygen on everybody.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, and once upon a time, it was also common to give every MI patient a prophylactic dose of lidocaine just in case. But we don't do that anymore, because the science proved that it was not beneficial, harmful in a great many cases, and unnecessary. And I think that's the point we're at with spinal mobilization.
We needed more body bags.
Yeah, it's no longer a case of, some of the evidence is equivocal. I mean, we've had two meta-analyses on available research now, and both of them concluded that there's no benefit from spinal mobilization.
So I just want to kind of digress just for a second. We do have people that listen to it who aren't very much into research on that. And you even start talking research, they just start to glaze over. But I think that in EMS, we have to understand that research is a vital aspect of what we do, and it's not going away, and we need to learn about it. So real quickly, what is a meta-analysis?
It's crunching the numbers of all the available research out there. To put it in one term, it's one big study looking at all the existing studies, and evaluating their data. And it's been done twice now on the available research for, spinal mobilization. And still there is no, evidence of benefit, even for spinally injured patients.
And the irony of a meta-analysis is there's really only been one large-scale study on whether spinal immobilization is beneficial. So doing a meta-analysis of a single study, you know, where does that get you? It gets you the results of the original study, which showed that patients who were spinally immobilized in the U.S. were twice as likely to be disabled as the patients who were not spinally immobilized and had unstable spinal injuries in Malaysia.
Yeah.
Now, how did they come to this conclusion? I mean, how did they determine this?
It was retrospective analysis of a bunch of patients into the University of New Mexico Trauma Center, where everybody who had mechanism was immobilized. They did not have any records of any patient with any spinal injury coming in who was not immobilized during the study period. And they compared them with Malaysia, where they have no EMS system at the time. And they compared the patients who came in with spinal trauma injury to the spine with those with similar injuries in the U.S. And it's difficult to do matched pairs analysis of patients with spinal injuries because there are so many differences. But the unstable spinal injuries, you had twice as much disability among the patients who were immobilized in the U.S. as you did among the patients in Malaysia who got there by walking, by being carried, by being thrown over the shoulder or put on an ox or however they got there, in the back of a taxi cab.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing is, you know, when you look at studies, you can kind of tweak them to however you want them to go. Now, when they did these studies, did they compare injuries and severity of patients against other ones? Or, because I mean, I've backboarded a lot of patients that there was really not a lot wrong with them, but they got a backboard. versus my multi-systems trauma patients.
Yeah. Well, in the Malaya study, you're comparing two different patient populations. Of course, in the United States, there was a much higher incidence of motor vehicle trauma than there was in the Malaya subgroup. But from what I've read of it, the injury severity scores and the neurological scores of the patients in each group were fairly well matched. So their injuries, regardless of how those injuries came about, were comparable. Yet the non-immobilized Malayan patients, as Tim pointed out, had twice as good a neurologic recovery as the immobilized patients in University of New Mexico. That's pretty compelling evidence right there that, you know, whatever we're doing isn't working. Are there patients out there that spinal mobilization could potentially benefit? Maybe. But, you know, at least in one study with several hundred patients in each group, there was no evidence of benefit. In fact, there's pretty compelling evidence of harm.
And that harm doesn't have to be just worsening of a neurological injury.
Oh, no. There's a constellation of stuff.
All kinds of potential bad side effects. And with the evolution that we're doing in my system, the two new goals of spinal motion restriction, which is the terminology that the lawyers have kind of forced us to, because we can't really truly immobilize anybody, we can restrict their motion. The two goals I have is that where there is spinal motion restriction indicated by, we're using primarily the main criteria, that we restrict the motion in all axes of motion and try to prevent or minimize the adverse effects of that SMR. So we've added a second balancing point to the whole process that we're trying to get through.
But if these studies say that it's such a bad thing, why are we even doing it?
Fear of lawyers.
Tradition.
So the dogma.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And inertia.
But then why aren't we giving lidocaine to every of our, you know, patients? That showed that it was ineffective.
The cardiac arrhythmia suppression trial of 1989, which showed that patients, it was looking at post-MI patients with frequent PVCs. We knew that more patients after a heart attack with PVCs, they were more frequently dying than patients who didn't have PVCs. So, excuse me. The obvious thing to do is to get rid of the PVCs because the PVCs are what's killing the patient. Well, we gave them antiarrhythmics and we did a great job of getting rid of the PVCs. The problem was it wasn't the PVCs that were killing the patients. The PVCs were an indicator of damage to the heart. And what we were doing is poisoning the conduction system. And that was what ended up killing 2 to 3 times the number, the percentage of patients in two of the treatment groups as in the placebo group. So when you're looking at something like that, you say, the lawyers get a hold of this. We're in deep trouble. And that study was much larger than the Hauswald study because it was a comparison to see which was the best antiarrhythmic. And they wanted survival studies. They had lots of surrogate endpoint studies, which showed, yeah, we get rid of PVCs wonderfully. But they wanted to see which one was the best at improving survival. So they made it a huge study. Yeah. They ended up stopping it when they found just how deadly the treatment was.
So kind of taking the mobilization aspect and comparing it to that, is there anything out there that shows that immobilization is beneficial?
No. There is a response to the Cochrane study that was published Journal of Emergency Medicine, I think it was, back in 2004, where a doctor listed about a half dozen to maybe 10 studies, which were all just case studies that showed that patients, when their neck was manipulated, ended up with spinal injuries. And it is presumed that this would have been prevented by what we do to patients. The problem is when we strap somebody to a board. We aren't restricting motion. We are manipulating their neck into the collar and then manipulating their back onto the backboard. So we're not doing spinal motion restriction. We are doing spinal manipulation. Well, why are we ending up with twice as many patients with spinal injuries in the U.S.? Because we are the ones manipulating their spine. What Dr. Hauswald suggested in his paper is that a patient who is awake, maybe not even fully alert, pain is going to keep them from moving their neck in a way that is harmful.
Right.
You know, Kyle, you and I sat in that lecture at EMS Today last year, I forget the doctor who was doing the lecture on selective spinal mobilization. But, right. You know, I sprained my neck nodding in agreement throughout the whole thing. You know, and he pointed out that you know, pain is a good thing in these things. Number one, in the alert patient, pain is going to probably be a better inducement for self-splinting than anything else. Plus, it's also your defining characteristic that something is wrong. Generally speaking, you know, in a competent patient, lack of pain is a very good indicator that there's nothing, you know, there's not going to be any benefit to immobilizing it. And he pointed out, if you'll recall, in the patients with internal decapitation and the high C-spine injuries, that the act of putting on a properly sized cervical collar resulted in up to an inch and a half or more of cervical distraction. You know, just putting on the right size C collar pulls their neck apart that much.
And we've been teaching that for how long?
Oh, well, since I've been in EMS.
Measure it right, you know.
Yeah.
Get the appropriate size collar. And it's just everything we've gone against has been changing, but we're still stuck in this aspect. And Dr. Romig, I'll kind of toss this over to you, you know, for a second. You know, I spent a lot of times as a paramedic in the Maryland system. And there you went to shock trauma. So you had the trauma surgeons, and anyone that, you know, had suspected spinal injuries that weren't complacent with their immobilization were, well, you know, paralyzed and intubated on that. Where in emergency departments...
That helps with assessment.
Hey, it's great. Keep them still and quiet. But then you go to an emergency department, and with emergency physicians... And you get the same patient, they're ripping everything off. And I sat there looking at this doc, who, by the way, is also working at a trauma center. It's a combined hospital. And I'm asking him, I'm like, so what's the difference here? He goes, well, essentially, our view is if they can take everything off, they probably don't have a spinal injury.
I think I always approached it with a little bit more science than that. I guess I probably... got it through my EM residency, and that was basically following the same kind of criteria that were being used at the time and still are being used in Maine, maybe a combination of some of the Canadian decision rules as well. I know from the EMS perspective, it was extremely frustrating for our folks to have taken, well, sometimes at least a great deal of care in packaging somebody only to wheel them in and find that not just a physician was clearing the patient off of the board, but nurses were without even consulting physicians in the process. And that was tough for some people to deal with. And it took me a while to come around to the possibility that I could do this selective stuff in my system with 800 paramedics and 800 EMTs. And so far we're still having to create believers in some of the rules that we changed.
So why do we? Why are we still? We're seeing this information. We'll get into a little bit more in depth in a little bit. But why are we still so insistent?
Dr. Roman, you deal with pediatric patients.
We do. Not a lot.
No, it's the other one. This is the evil twin.
Yeah, this...
Or is the other one the evil twin? I can't keep track of which one.
No, Lou is the evil twin.
Oh, Lou's the evil twin, okay.
Beginning to wonder.
Hey, I have the cup to prove it. Different story.
Oh.
Yes, but Lou, I mean, you know, I've spoken with Lou about this in my process of research for changing our practices. And the problem is that there is so little research in the kids that even though you want to do evidence-based medicine, there's not a whole lot of evidence to base your medicine on.
Yeah.
Her gut feeling is that most of the kids that they see don't require spinal motion restriction.
I think it causes more problems.
Do you restrict what a child does? If you strap them down, what they're doing is isometric exercise against the straps. If anything, they are putting much more, exponentially more force on their neck by fighting against it, pulling against the straps, than they would if we transported them without strapping them down.
And that is part of a big debate that, as a medical control doc, we have to face. You know, we would always have people calling us because of requirements saying that, hey, I don't think this kid's going to tolerate being SMR'd. You know, they're all, you know, bouncing off the walls as it is. One thing that I always said was that at least in some young age range, a lot of the kids will calm down after you get them kind of papoosed and snugged up. However, I think a lot of the kids, it's probably true. We fight or cause them to fight us even more when we try to SMR them. And I think the point about pain being a natural motion restrictor, it's a great point.
Yeah.
And if they calm down after you get them restrained, how much damage is done just to get them to that point? If the spine is unstable, aren't you going to do more or all of the damage before they calm down? And if they calm down, is it because you broke their neck or because they just are giving up on fighting?
We're not told at this point.
You don't find out till X-ray.
Right.
Or until you ask them to move their feet or tickle them.
And, you know, it made me wonder a little bit on the pediatric side. We've got a pediatric hospital in my county, and in talking with them, they would basically just take kids out of all of our spinal motion restriction. They'd leave a collar on and then not keep the rest of the body SMR'd. And to me, that didn't make much sense. You're either going to do it or you're not going to do it.
But why do you think that the backboard adds anything to it? The backboard was really just for extrication. The collar is to keep the patient from moving their neck. They're designed for two different purposes. We put them together, so we assume that they go together, but there's no natural connection between them except that they're in the same protocol.
Well, one of the things that when PALS first came around, and Lou and I were doing a lot of teaching of PALS, you know, the old song, the neck bone connected to the backbone connected to the da-da-da-da-da, where you can get force transmitted up through the spine. And I think that was probably at least part of the, this would seem to make sense way that our spinal immobilization process is developed. It was just a logical thought process is all it came from. And there are a number of good descriptions about the history of spinal immobilization in some of the articles, the Doe-Meyer articles and Housewald's and a number of the other ones.
Mm-hmm. Now, the collar usually is switched from our EMS collar, which is a rigid, much less comfortable collar, to a softer collar, not the whiplash collar that the lawyers give them, but the Philadelphia collar and other similar ones that's more comfortable for the patient, is less putting pressure, distracting pressure on the bottom of the chin to separate the vertebrae, and actually may prevent the patient from moving in a way that isn't annoying the patient, causing them to move more.
Well, it's the original collars that I started out with, the two-piece Philly collars.
Right.
And that's what most ERs use.
Trauma center.
Yeah, that's what everyone uses. Now, I want to put this over to Bob for a second, because Bob's been in the business for a while, and he's seen the changes that have happened. Bob, I mean, Bob, what have you seen? I mean, what's your thought process on this whole thing?
Well, the first thing is listening to everybody, it makes me think of a fire department analogy, and I guess for EMS it would be, you know, 50 years of tradition unimpeded by progress. Because we've been doing this since day one, and I've also been through a lot of the situations that other people were talking about where, you know, we actually wrestled patients down and told them that, you know, they had to have this done, and you always wondered in the end if you were accomplishing what you, you know, meant out what you wanted to do in the first place.
You break their neck and you say, "See, I told you I had a spinal injury."
Yeah.
I'm having flashes of that episode of Highway Patrol. Holy crap, Johnson.
Did you do the poke the spine test?
Doesn't she understand the scientificness of that test?
Yeah.
I didn't spend 122 days in EMT school.
Bob, go ahead.
I said the bad news is I haven't seen many changes. I mean, we have, you know, come up with a selective spinal motion restriction protocol.
We have much more colorful backboards now.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, I think the best thing I heard even 25 years ago when this discussion started at a conference was that the backboard was the EMS billboard, and everybody felt if you didn't get it out at the accident and show it to everybody and then put somebody on it, they would feel like you never, you know, did your job.
Well, the problem is it has somebody else's company's name on it.
Oh, never done that one. But I mean, you know, I think how we've done it. I mean, we went from the days of the soft collar, the white, as you mentioned earlier, the whiplash collar, and the sandbags that we saw on emergency and the boards, to these really highly scientific devices that we out there. You can't go to a trade show without seeing the newest and latest devices. I think I saw one the other day at one of the trade shows that locks the person in. It's almost like a halo. Yeah.
The X collar.
Yes, I was like, oh my goodness. Are you?
And it does keep you from moving your head. The only question being is, was it necessary in the first place?
Now I think
does it get your head into the position it should be in to prevent injury?
Exactly. You know, one of my reservations with spinal immobilization or spinal motion restriction are, you know, come from several different areas. First of all, the principle behind it is questionable at best. You know, the neurosurgeons will tell you that, you know, your spinal cord injuries are basically divided into two broad categories, your primary cord injury and your secondary cord injury. And what we're trying to do, presumably, with immobilization is limit secondary cord injury.
Right.
Yet
we're creating tertiary.
Yeah. Yet movement within the natural plane, within the natural range of motion, is not really likely to do that, even in the patients with unstable spine. Secondly, is the treatment we're rendering actually doing what it's intended? And for the most cases, it's not. The cervical collars fit so poorly. Or when they are appropriately sized, result in a lot of distraction. You put them on the board. In most cases, the spine is not in a neutral in-line position. So the treatment as we're rendering it is insufficient. Not to mention the fact that we're searching for, we use really dubious reasons to put people on the boards. You know, we're putting people on boards based on mechanism of injury. No, why are we doing that? Are we doing damage analysis for insurance companies based on car bumpers, or are we taking care of people?
They just don't understand the scientificness.
Yeah. We need to come up with a better poke the spine test. That's what we need. Yeah,
we're trying to prevent them from becoming tachycardic by applying bilateral carotid sinus massage.
Now, how much of this do you think is we're doing, not so much because of dogma, but because of our QA people?
I don't know that it's so much the QA people as it is the attorneys, you know, because although the typical trauma training programs out there for EMS are starting to include some of the selective SMR stuff, there's all kinds of things for attorneys and expert witnesses to point at and say, obviously, they didn't immobilize this patient and they caused this patient to have permanent injury and paralysis. That's a lot of it.
The problem is the expert witnesses are completely wrong. And what we need, in addition to modifying the malpractice system, is to come up with some expert witnesses who say there is nothing obvious about it. If it were obvious, you would have some research that would show that this is connected to that. And there is no research out there that shows that spinal immobilization has ever prevented any spinal injury, ever.
Exactly. You know, it's the legal beagles will tell you that in a malpractice case, it's going to be won by whose expert is more believable.
Yep.
Bottom line is you're asking 12 people who didn't know how to get out of jury duty to pass judgment on your care, and they're going to listen to the person that is the expert that is the most believable. Now, you give me an expert with a ream of paperwork, a ream of studies there, demonstrating that the practice that you did not apply is harmful and thus should not be applied. That's your expert. And now the plaintiff's expert is some guy whose only reasoning is, duh, that's the way we've always done it. You know, I'll take my guy any day. I think that guy is more believable.
The problem is a jury is generally chosen for being as little informed about what they're going to decide as possible.
Right.
It's where we go wrong in the legal system. We need to have a jury of people who have an understanding of both science and medicine.
But do you think that the besides just the lawyers, do you think, and Dr. Roman, please don't take this personally on this, but I think you're up to date on it because you are a medical director, but do you think a lot of ER physicians aren't even up on this? They're automatically saying, why is this person not immobilized?
I would say less so now than maybe 10 years ago, but I don't doubt that, especially in maybe some of the smaller hospitals, non-trauma centers, that there could be a component of that. And we've certainly seen that coming from complaints from hospitals to us over the years. They'll second guess us about this person should have been immobilized. And I have to say that probably the issues that we have had have been mostly with elderly people and falls, as opposed to motor vehicle crashes, which we're really trying to focus on here today. And so maybe falls and the elderly are a little bit of a special case.
And now, are you finding the elderly are not being immobilized or are being immobilized?
We're not being immobilized.
Okay. So why would that make a difference in this discussion, being elderly? We can apply it to the car accident as well.
Well, it's not just the elderly. It's the other things that tend to go along with it. If you just look at the main criteria, if you've got somebody that's over 65, they say that more attention needs to be paid to them because they tend to have less typical presentations. In my county, the land of the newlywed and the nearly dead, where we have had – oh, that's really old. Where we have had elderly folks with significant cervical injuries have been patients who weren't immobilized, but they had altered mental status or at least one or two of the criteria that Maine says, this one's not an automatic, do not immobilize.
But would immobilization have changed the outcome or would it have made it worse?
I don't know.
I think that's the thing, is that we see a lot of this research and we understand the aspect about the osteoporosis and everything we've been talking about, and you know, you get neuropathies and all sorts of interesting things. And I mean, taking the altered mental status, I think you gotta kinda take that out of there. You have to be able to get a good, you know, history of illness and or complaint, and as well as a good physical exam. But with everything we're talking about, you know, I guess I'm not quite sure why the geriatric population would fall into that. I think that they're, you know, you put them onto a backboard, you already start to get, you know, breakdown. you know, of skin. You cause more issues. I think we cause more issues with them.
Yep. And I will
COPD.
I would say that the way we've gone, where before, you know, the end all be all is a collar and a board, what we now have is we've permitted our folks to determine what the least adversely affecting method of motion restriction might be. For example, we have pediatric vacuum splints, and we have so many people with kyphosis. They work really well for providing some stabilization for those patients where we can't really get a good exam and a feel for whether or not they might have a significant injury. And we're playing with other combinations of things that on an individual case-by-case basis may work best for that individual patient.
Now, I mean, it's nice to get the mobilization splints, but there's a lot of folks who don't have that. They have the good old-fashioned backboard.
Well, yes, but there are other things out there, too. Keds and collars. We still do that a lot.
And well, you know, it's lots and lots of blankets to pad the board.
Absolutely,
you
know,
you get some patients with such severe kyphosis or scoliosis that if you get them to lay flat on the board, it's only by breaking their back that you'll do it.
But then I guess we go right back to where we started from. Are we doing more manipulation? Are we actually, is this effective? I mean, you get someone with a kyphosis on a board, I've done it, the padding, and they're rocking back and forth because they really don't sit on there well. They would be better sitting, you know, in a semi-Fowler's position, you know, on the stretcher with a backup with maybe a collar on. And you can't even put a collar on these folks. Maybe the good old-fashioned horse collar. I mean, it goes right back. Are we doing more manipulation and more jerry-rigging?
Effective as opposed to just at waving the magic backboard and getting the lawyer to say, that couldn't have been the cause of the spinal injury, or effective at preventing the patient from having spinal injuries. They're two entirely different questions. We spinal immobilized the patient at the expense of the patient to protect ourselves from the patient, not to protect the patient from injury.
You know, if we spinally immobilized 75% less patients than we currently do, and thus bought 75% less spine boards every year, 75% less cervical collars and head blocks, and instead use that money to buy maybe a nice vacuum splint, don't you think that money would be better spent in that avenue than? You know, and the vacuum splints are not that prohibitively expensive anymore. They make a full body vacuum splint that's rugged enough to be used multiple times for $100.
And if we started buying them in volume, the cost would come down.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that very argument is one that I used in getting the approval that I have to get for my protocol changes.
No, what was that, Dr. Robing? I'm sorry.
The argument about if we use fewer traditional collars and fewer backboards, ultimately that's going to save us some money that may be better plowed into, as was said, vacuum splints or other, maybe even other drugs that we're running short on.
Yeah. 'Cause you're also subsidizing all the services in the surrounding areas that have less liberal spinal motion restriction protocols than you do.
Yeah.
You know.
I worked in a trauma center, and one of the things I did as a large part of the job was to package up the backboards and send them out UPS to all the services that flew patients there and were not going to drive all the way into the trauma center because they were at least 10 minutes away.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Dr. Roman, how did you finally come to the conclusion, say, okay, let's institute this new radical protocol? I mean, you know... And how does your system differ than others, or they're similar to some of the other programs that are out there?
Well, you know, for a long time, I just based on the size of my system, we do 170,000 responses a year, 130 some odd thousand transports. As I said, I think before 800 ENTs and 800 medics. So the size of our system and the diversity of both education and motivation, if you will, makes for a difficult time in trying to give more discretion to folks in the field. And somehow or other, and I'm not sure why it was, but I think it was actually, now that I say it, we were researching, we needed to find a substitute for our pediatric backboards because the one we had been using was no longer being manufactured. And that caused me to start looking into the literature. And the more I read of the literature, the more relatively straightforward the criteria that have actually been shown to work pretty well, although may still over triage to SMR, that it wasn't as complex as I thought. And I said, hey, I made a check sheet, and it was, if all of these are checked no, then you can do this. If any one of them is checked yes, then you have to do this. But here are more options for you to fit the method to the patient rather than trying to cram everybody into a board and collar. And so I think it started with the need for a piece of equipment, and through enlightenment and being open-minded and evidence-based medicine-minded, that that's the way we evolved.
Now, we've been talking a lot about, you know, the spinal mobilization, or I should say restriction on that, and, you know, the backboard and collars. But, you know, first few moments really works at the motor vehicle crash, and a lot of our patients we find still in the vehicle. And technically, if you go by the standard of care that is taught in every trauma program that's out there and every EMT and paramedic course, the standard of care is if you're taking them out of that car and they're not a critical patient, they're immobilized using the KED.
And how often is that really done?
Exactly. And, you know, I'll tell you, I have used it. I use it. And I like to consider those the patients that are kind of the in-between patients. It's sitting there going, ooh, this doesn't look... The ones you're concerned about, you know, they're sitting there, they got the neck pain, they got tingling in their hands, you know, there's something going, I think I got a neck injury on this person. Okay, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do as carefully and cautiously as possible, the way we're taught. But then you get those patients, it's like the all-state-itis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my neck, my back. They weigh, you know, 400 pounds. They're in a smart car and with bucket seats.
Isn't that like a car seat? So you just transport them in it?
I want to do that.
Put a smart car up on the stretcher and take them in. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need the hydraulic assist stretchers for that.
Oh, we have those.
Yeah, I mean, that's my goal, is to take one of those things, put it on the back end of a flatbed tow truck and show up at the trauma center going, hi, here we are.
Yeah, you wanted to know what the car looked like. Here it is.
Sometimes you wonder how often the KED is applied as a punitive immobilization device rather than a therapeutic one.
Now, what do you mean by that?
It's like, okay, pal, you called me out for this advanced case of all-state-itis. Here, I'm going to put on the most uncomfortable device I can on you, and knowing that when I bring them into the hospital, likely it's not, it'll stay on for a little while and get your trust up in this. Not only do we get to make your back uncomfortable, we get to put a lot of pressure on your groin as well. It's great, you know. Teach you to call 911 for this kind of stuff next time. I wonder how often the KED is used that way. But it's my I use the KED more often as my scoop stretcher for confined spaces. It's my hip immobilizer to get granny out of the small bathroom and into onto the stretcher. Or my improvised papoose restraint.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Rarely these days do I actually use it as an immobilization device in motor vehicle accidents.
But, and you know, when you put those on, especially in some of these cars with the seats, mm-hmm. the movement is just as much.
Oh, yeah. Well, now, and I can't find this, but Tim, being the research master, could probably put his hands on it right away. I think University of New Mexico did a study where they immobilized cadavers with surgically fractured spines and did fluoroscopic studies.
That was in Houston. Dr. Maddox was involved in that.
and with the KEDs, and they found out that the KED.
No, that was just the C collar.
No,
that was the one Dr. Bledsoe forwarded around. It might be Oswald.
Yeah, they had some cadavers that they surgically fractured their spines, took them out of cars using rapid extrication techniques, and some of them were taken out with a KED, and then they did, fluoroscoped them and discovered that there was a lot more manipulation in the KED group than there was in the rapid extrication group. Now they didn't have, I don't know that this was a very large thing. It was probably only a dozen cadavers or so, but point being is if the KED actually works well to immobilize the spine with minimum manipulation, that's a big presumption. How many EMT programs actually practice it the way it's done in the field? Or are you doing it in a well-lit classroom in a straight back chair with nothing in the way?
Yeah.
But what is the right way to do it?
Yeah. I've yet to be able to kneel down in front of someone in a car to put that KED on.
And Kelly, it's tested. I agree with Kelly because that's the way you always see it taught and tested. The other thing I'll throw out, I know some people on the panel are in warmer areas. If you're up here in Buffalo in January, just thinking about the KED, and by the time you manipulate the patient around, you can't feel your fingers anymore. That's a whole nother issue. We've been practicing therapeutic hypothermia at motor vehicle crashes for years while we get into mobilization.
Who says hypothermia worsens trauma patients?
So that goes back to Tim's thing. He had numbness and tingling in his hands and feet. Probably necessary. because we froze him to death putting it on.
Suspended animation, when they get out of that deep freeze, will come up with a cure for the spinal problem.
I mean, I think you also got to think about in terms of that is also safety. I mean, you have undeployed airbags. I think that's something you have to be concerned as with as well. Working in front of the steering column and such.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's true, Kyle. You can add, if you take every safety step that you need to do a proper extrication, if it's necessary, you can add another 10, 15, 20 minutes. Some of the capacitors that need to discharge even after the battery's disconnected take quite a while. Then once you do get the KED on, do you need to cut the roof off the car with just the fender damage now to, achieve your ultimate goal of properly removing the patient?
Johnson, cut this one too. Just in case.
The EMS motto, if we can do it, we should do it.
If it helps only one patient, it's worth it.
No matter how many it kills. That is a great statement, Kelly and Tim. I mean, how often have we heard that? How often have we maybe over the years have said that? And we're starting to realize maybe that's not the best.
We're practicing alternative medicine. That is what the people who sell acupuncture and Reiki and homeopathy and all sorts of other snake oil live on. What if it helps just one patient? Isn't it worth it for that? No, it's a placebo. It is an elaborate placebo that is purely deluding the patient about what is going on, and that is it. If we want to have a placebo, we need to figure out what it is about the placebo effect that is beneficial and a safe way to apply it. Sticking a big needle into somebody who doesn't need needle decompression is probably not the way to go.
But you mean we're not supposed to pop everybody's chest?
Well, at least the acupuncture needles are long enough to reach the lung that might have been collapsed.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we need to emphasize in to help sell the idea of selective spinal restriction to the stalwarts who still insist on immobilizing everyone and letting the radiologist sort them out. We need to make point of the fact that spinal you know, boarding people is not a benign procedure. It is not one of those things where you can do it and say, well, you know, no harm, no foul if they didn't need it. You know, as Laurie pointed out, there are constellation of problems that can arise from boarding someone. We've got a guy in a local nursing home who the only reason he's there is because a paramedic told him that he had to go on a board if he wanted to get in his ambulance. And the guy vomited, aspirated, coded, you know, and now he's a nursing home patient. And he was ambulatory at the scene of a minor accident. We need to make point of the fact that, that boarding is not a benign procedure. It causes problems.
Kelly, that sounds like a save to me.
Yeah. Well,
he's still alive.
He got into the hospital alive and neurologically intact.
Now, Dr. Romick,
it saves just that one guy. How can we criticize this?
We need to emphasize the concept of number needed to treat and number needed to harm.
And that's exactly where I was going to go next.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
Run with it.
I think a good example of where the literature is starting to generate some of that on this topic is the research about SMR and penetrating trauma patients. I know that's not motor vehicle crashes, but they have come up.
Depends where you are.
Number needed to treat and number needed to harm. And the number of patients that you would have to spinally motion restrict with penetrating trauma in order to benefit one patient was something astronomical.
But the number was completely made up. They have nothing to base it on because there's still no evidence that any patient ever benefited from any immobilization.
Well,
yeah. So the number needed to harm can be calculated. The number needed to benefit is, well, you know, what's the number of people on this planet and the number of people who might ever live on this planet? And it might still be larger than that.
Well, 47.3% of statistics are made up on the spot anyway. So,
well, I'm here for the other 52.7%.
60% of the time, it works every time.
So, well, obviously, you need to know what kind of definitions are being made by any given study as to what they're considering benefiting from the procedure. But yeah, especially in that penetrating trauma group, it's plain.
PHTLS is no longer recommending spinal immobilization for penetrating trauma. So any place that is still doing that is violating PHTLS and what did you say, ATLS?
ITLS.
ITLS, because ATLS and PHTLS are based on the same guidelines. Right. That's the newest guidelines out there. The study that was done by Johns Hopkins looking at the National Trauma Data Bank on patients who were spinally immobilized. I agree with the results. The problem is their data doesn't show it because the data don't make any sense. If you look at the patients who were spinally immobilized, there are almost as many patients who were put in mast pants. So think of the trauma patients you see. Do you see as many patients with a mast on as on a backboard? No. So there's something wrong with the database that they used for it. And that is a big problem with that study. I agree with the results, but their study is not what proves it. It's all the other research before then that shows that a patient without neurological deficit who has any penetrating injury should not be immobilized. You're more likely to kill him by immobilizing him than you are to provide any remote benefit.
There's something like 2 times as likely to die.
I think it was two times as likely with stab wounds and three times as likely with gunshot wounds. But again, the database is flawed. So if you use their statistics, you're hoping that they had the blind squirrel moment and that was their nut.
But the fun thing about that statement is that a lot of times you'll have these patients who are stabbed, but also are subject of multisystems trauma from assaults. So if you look at most of the spinal mobilization protocols, if you have a distracting injury, you can't say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and not immobilize you.
Well, and
the PHTLS now says unless they're showing signs of spinal disability.
Well, and going back to Kyle's point about assault patients, here's an example of how poorly written protocols can do the exact opposite of the intent of protocols in the first place. You know, protocols are designed, should be, to make sure that the least competent paramedic renders it at least the same basic care as the best paramedic in the system. Yet the way they're written,
that always works.
The way they're written most often is that they force the best paramedic in the system to lower his level of care to that of the least competent medic in the system. And case in point, the way our spinal, we have a selective spinal motion restriction protocol. We're allowed to use our judgment somewhat in who we immobilize or restrict, rather. But there are a couple of extra criteria they throw in there that make it all moot point. One being age over 65. If someone, you know, has a fall and they're over 65, they got to get boarded. Okay.
Which I think is cruel.
Yes. Very cruel.
Very cruel.
And I always make that point. If I've got a reliable patient, I'll say, you know, I'm going to have to strap you on this big, hard board. It's going to be so uncomfortable. And they go, oh, really? Do I have to be on that thing? Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. Are you telling me you don't want it? Okay, well, that's fine. I'll document that, and we won't have to put you on that mean old thing.
It's a shame that we have to do that.
Yeah, it is.
You call medical command, and you say, how much sedative do you want me to give this patient for them to be able to tolerate immobilization? Because otherwise, they're only going to worsen their injury. Usually the response I get back is no sedation, no immobilization.
The other criteria that really throws a wrench into the what would be otherwise a fairly good protocol is significant injury above the clavicles. Now, I think the term significant actually has significance, but the way ours is written, it just says injury above the clavicles. So here I am. I'm called to a bar fight. You know, some guy was at the bar and he was, you know, the typical thing. He was sitting there drinking a wholesome glass of milk, reading the Bible, minding his own business. And when all of a sudden, for no reason, someone popped him in the mouth.
Some dude.
Yeah, some
two dude. Two dudes.
Some dude and usually his henchman Mookie. But
Mongo.
Yeah. Hit this guy in the mouth. Busted his lip, maybe broke his nose, but he never left his feet. He's neurologically intact. He is awake, alert, and oriented. He just wants to go have his busted lip stitched up and maybe make sure he didn't loosen some teeth. Yet I have to tell him that I have to strap him to a board. Now, where is the sense in that?
Yeah.
I don't know that your average punch in the face is going to break someone's neck. And if it were, you'd kind of know it. Your neck.
Look at boxing. Why don't we have the EMS at every boxing match
football
and take them out of the ring on a backboard at the end of the fight? Because each of them has had mechanism of injury that is much greater than most car accidents ever will produce. And they walk out of the ring on their own.
That's a good argument.
Yeah, that is a great argument. But
Mike Tyson used to hit people and they'd go flying across the ring. They'd be unconscious for maybe a minute. They'd get up and they'd walk out of the ring. If somebody were there with the backboard, we'd be nailing them to the board to keep them from getting up.
And that's an absolutely fantastic point, Kelly. And I kind of, you know, we're coming up on an hour. I just want to kind of ask one question here and to Dr. Romig, and because you're on a lot of the boards, you see what's going on out there. Do you foresee potentially or that we may just go to just a collar. Unless, of course, we have like lower back injuries and stuff like that. But, you know, just simply a collar. We see it in the ERs all the time.
Yeah,
they take them off the board and put them on a bed with a collar.
What I don't know is whether even we would need to make that stop. You know, whether if that's going to be an incremental change or if we just all of a sudden determine that the vast majority of our folks, unless they meet pretty restrictive criteria, don't need any SMR at all. And I'm not sure that one isn't any better or worse than the other.
So potentially it may just be unless they have major neurological deficits or their neck is in a weird direction or they're missing a bump.
Neurological deficits, what do we use as the right method of preventing further injury? We have no studies that show us what's the best way to protect a patient against further injury. And that's the whole idea. That's what everybody wants to do. Even the people who are saying immobilize everybody, they're not doing it out of malice. They're doing it because we want to minimize further injury, which is the right thing to want to do.
But that's a
we
very
have
nebulous
no
thing to quantify.
Idea what works.
But as
it requires a lot of patients because the rate of spinal injury is so small, and we don't know how much we contribute to.
That's a good point, you know, and that is it's not so much whether they have deficits or not, but it goes right down to the aspect: is the actual procedure causing injury? And that is something that's going to be interesting to watch and to see as we grow as a system. So we're just about an hour here. I'm going to thank my panel so much for joining us. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Tim Noonan. Tim, thank you so much. Any closing remarks, and where can we find you?
Thank you. You can find me at roguematic.com. We had a little outage tonight. I think it was the Lasix police or the spinal immobilization police coming after me, but we're back up again. Also at paramedicine101.com, and if we ever get it started again, researchems.com, or is it .net? And occasionally on standing orders and, you know, here and there.
Here and
but
there.
I might be doing something regular on standing orders. Still working it out.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Mr. Russell Stein, any last comments, and where can we find you?
I just want to make a comment real quick that if anybody's been paying attention to the national championship game, Alabama's winning 9-0.
Shut up.
but if they had immobilized somebody, it would have changed the outcome.
Oh, no. It's only halftime, so we'll see what happens. But
looks like
I'm at
Kickers had a kick.
Yeah, apparently it's a field goal shootout. But, hey, it was exactly what everyone predicted it would be. But anyway, I'm at hybridmedic.com, and go Pokes.
And what's the other one?
That one's shut down.
Oh.
Ew. Well, Russell, thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
Bob, any closing remarks, and where can we get a hold of you?
Just thanks for the invite. It was very interesting, enjoyable, and educational, and you can get a hold of me by getting a hold of you.
No problem. Thanks, Bob, for joining us. Also, Dr. Lori Romig, thank you.
Thanks for tolerating me here with the rest of the street folks.
Oh, no. It's great to have you on.
I really appreciate the ability to participate. It's a great topic, and I think we're going to see some significant change over the next couple of years. You can find me at Dr. Romig, DrRomig, at medcontrol.com. Our office website is medcontrol.com. And I'll pitch Lou's website as well. It's www.jumpstarttriage.com. And I do have, she has allowed me one page that is titled The Other Dr. Romig, so you can get me through there too.
It took me a while. I was going on there, looking back and forth, going, what is Lou doing here? I can't figure it out. Then I realized I didn't know you existed at that time. So That was funny. So thank you so much, Dr. Romig, for joining us. And last but not least, he actually gave up part of the LSU game to join us, and it looks like it's probably a good thing, Mr. Kelly Grayson.
Well, I appreciate you having me, Kyle. But it's a good topic, and I think Laurie was right. We're going to see a sea change in how we approach spinal motion restriction in the future, and hopefully we'll approach the with a little more common sense and evidence based medicine rather than dogma and tradition and fear of lawyers. You guys can reach me at Kelly at ambulancedriverfiles.com. On Twitter as at AmboDriver. My blog is ambulancedriverfiles.com, and you can also find me on the Confessions of an EMS Newbie podcast, emsnewbie.com, with Ron Davis.
Yes, definitely. Go check it out, folks. It's a great podcast. So
he's no longer a newbie now, is he?
But he says he's going to be a newbie for 2 years after he gets his certification. Then we're going to have to find ourselves a new newbie to mentor.
Excellent. Thank
a noob.
A noob. Thank you so much, Kelly, for joining us. And my name is Kyle David Bates. You can find me here at firstfewmoments.com, on Twitter at ImageMedic. You can find me over at my other project, one that I work with Dr. Lou Romig at pedidu.com, our podcast. That was been on a little bit of a hiatus trying to get everyone together for that. But we're actually scheduled to record here. Hopefully everyone makes it. We'll be doing a children with special health care needs. So that should be up in the next couple of weeks here. And trach management with Dr. Patricia Cantwell joining us as well. So, folks, you know, it's been a discussion. And I think a lot of us who've been in EMS any period of time have seen this coming. We kind of made those own selective immobilizations throughout the years. And it's starting to change. But the one thing I do have to stress on this is that please follow your protocols. Please follow the wishes of your medical director on that. This podcast is meant for discussion and hopefully thought provocation on that. So just don't, you know, sit there and say, oh, I'm not going to immobilize them because they told me not to on the First Few Moments podcast. So please follow your medical directors and your protocols and your standard of care in your system. But it is something to talk about. It is something to start to see, you know, is it something that is more harmful than helpful? And keep your eye out for it. Because I think, you know, like we said, we've been talking about this over the last couple of years and it's still been a hot topic. We've still seen it out there. So for Tim, Lori, Kelly, Bob, Russ, and myself, thank you very much. Have a great night and stay safe out there.